Whatever you're afraid I'll find out is still safe. And it'll stay that way. Unless you give me a reason to start looking for it. I'll do my best not to, I promised, picking up my own drink with a shaky hand. I'm glad to hear it. Her smile was warm again. Because I was hoping you could help me.
Help you with what?
I asked, already sure I wasn't going to like the answer. The conference suite was less crowded this time, although since two of the others present were Lord General Zyvan and an Inquisitor who was already making it perfectly clear that she was in charge here, it certainly seemed full enough to me. The only other person present was Mott, the elderly savant, who sat bright and alert, occasionally poking at the dent in his leg left by a hasty tech priest who hadn't quite finished patching him up when the summons to the meeting had arrived. "Thank you for joining us, Commissar." Amberley flashed me a smile which looked genuinely warm, although as an experienced manipulator myself, I wasn't quite sure how far I could trust it. Zyvan nodded a greeting, also pleased to see me.
"Hello again,"
Mott smiled, surprisingly clear brown eyes flickering behind his excess of beard. He evidently hadn't found the time to wash the smell of the fire out of his hair and robes, or simply didn't care.
"You've caused us a great deal of inconvenience, young man. Although I suppose you weren't to know."
"Know what?" I asked, trying not to snap. I grabbed a couple of sandwiches to try and mop up the alcohol I'd drunk, and got Jürgen to find me some recaf, but between the Amasek and the reaction from the day's adventures, my head was still buzzing. All in good time. Amberley smiled indulgently at the wizened sage. Caractacus does tend to skip the dull bits given half a chance.
"When you get to my age, you don't have time to waste on them," he responded, smiling in return.
I realized that this was all part of an easy familiarity between them, which spoke volumes for the trust the Inquisitor placed in him, and the length of their association. He turned back to me.
"Which reminds me, thank you for coming to our assistance. It was most timely."
"My pleasure," I said.
"Then you have an extremely perverse idea of what constitutes fun. You should get out more."
Amberley shook her head and raised an eyebrow at me in an exaggerated mime of exasperation. "You just can't get the help these days," she said. I couldn't think of any adequate response to this, so I said nothing. I'd never had a really clear idea of what an Inquisitor was supposed to be like, although, like most people, I had a vague impression of some scary psychopath who slaughtered their way through the Emperor's enemies. Amberley, on the other hand, seemed to be the complete antithesis of this. She had her ruthless streak, of course, as I was to find out during our long association. But back then, the cheerful, slightly whimsical young woman with the strange sense of humour seemed about as far removed from the general preconception of a profession as it was possible to get. Zyvan cleared his throat.
"Which was, of course, the whole point."
"Inquisitor, perhaps we could get to the matter at hand."
"Of course." She activated the hololith, thumbing it in just the right spot to bring the image into focus. "It goes without saying that everything you see and hear is completely confidential, Commissar."
"Of course," I nodded.
"Good. I'd hate to have to kill you." She smiled again, and I wondered if she was joking or not. These days, of course, I know she meant every word of it. "In case you haven't been paying attention," she went on, "I'm an agent of the Ordo Xenos. You know what that means?" "You deal with aliens?" I hazarded. Back then, I had only the vaguest idea that the Inquisition was divided into multiple Ordos with specific areas of interest and responsibility, but it was a pretty easy deduction to make. Amberley nodded approval.
"Exactly,"
she began.
"For the most part, anyway," Mott chimed in helpfully. "There was that Chaos cult on Arcadia Secundus, and the Heretics of Gore. Thank you, Caractacus," she said, meaning shut the warp up.
So he did. As I was soon to discover, being a savant meant being obsessed with detail and trivia, and all the pedantry that went with it. Imagine the worst barroom know-it-all you ever met, who really does and is cursed with a Tourette-like compulsion to spill out everything relevant on any topic that comes up, and you're about halfway there. Although he could be incredibly annoying at times, I found him good company in his own way once I got to know him.
especially as his gifts included an uncanny intuitive grasp of probability, which we put to good use in a number of gambling establishments over the years. Amberley pulled up a star chart on the hololith, which I recognised without too much difficulty, as it had been reproduced in far less detail in the briefing slate I'd skimmed through before we made planetfall. "The Damocles Gulf," I said, and she nodded. "We're here." She pointed out the Gravelax system, seemingly alone and isolated on the fringes of Imperial space. "Notice anything about the topography of the region?" "We're close to the Tau border," I said, playing for time as I studied the images. She wouldn't be alluding to anything that obvious, I was sure. Several of the neighbouring systems were tagged with blue icons, marking them as Tau-held worlds. In fact, they almost engulfed our present position, with only a thin chain of friendly yellow beacons connecting us to the welcoming haven of Imperial space. "Too close," I concluded finally. "If we had to fight a war here, our supply lines would be far too thin for comfort."
"Precisely," Zyvan nodded approval and indicated a couple of choke points. "They could cut us off here and here with no trouble at all. We'd be blockaded and swallowed up in months, while they could reinforce at their leisure from at least four systems."
"Which is why we're so desperate to avoid a full-scale war over this miserable mudball," Amberley said. "Keeping it would tie up our naval assets from at least three sectors just to secure our supply lines, and we'd be funneling Guard and Astartes units in from all over the segmentum. Putting it bluntly, it's not worth the effort." To say that I was astonished would be putting it mildly. It had been an article of faith for as long as I could remember that the sacred domains of His Majesty's Imperium should never be polluted by the alien, no matter the cost. And here was an Inquisitor, no less, and the Lord General himself apparently quite happy to let the Tau just walk in and have the place. Well, that was fine with me, of course, especially if it kept me out of the firing line, so I nodded judiciously. "I can sense a but coming," I said.
"Quite right,"
Zyvan nodded, clearly pleased by my astuteness.
"Just letting the little blue Grox lovers walk in and take the place isn't acceptable either. It would send entirely the wrong message to them. They're already popping up on worlds all over the sector and arming to keep them. If they take Gravelax without a fight, they'll think half the segmentum is up for grabs."
"But we could beat them in the long run," I said, trying not to picture the decades of grinding attrition that would ensue as the overwhelming might of the Imperium met the techno-sorcery of the Tau. It would be the biggest bloodbath since the Sabbat World's Crusade. "We could, eventually," Amberley nodded soberly, "if they were the only threat we had to face." She widened the view, systems falling into the center of the hololith, new ones coalescing at the fringes of the projection field. Several systems were tagged in red. I recognized one of them as Corania, and then, a moment later, I picked out the Desolacia system, where I'd first been blooded against a Tyranid horde over a decade before.
"In the last few years, Tyranid attacks have been increasing in this region of the galaxy," Zyvan said. "But you'd know all about that."
"I've seen a few," I admitted.
"There's a pattern," Mott butted in. "Still not clear, but definitely beginning to form."
In hindsight, these were clearly the precursors of Hive Fleet's Kraken and Leviathan, the bulk of which had still to be detected at this time.
"Our greatest fear is that they could be the harbingers of a new Hive Fleet," Amberley said soberly. I tried to envision such a thing, and shivered involuntarily. The hordes I'd encountered before had been weak, the scattered survivors of Hive Fleet Behemoth, which had been shattered centuries before, but still dangerous shards of poison in the body of the Imperium. Even attenuated as they were, they could still overwhelm a lightly defended world, growing in strength with each one they consumed. The prospect of facing a fresh fleet with almost limitless resources was, quite simply, terrifying.
"Then let's pray you're wrong," I said. Unfortunately, as we now know, she was right twice over, and the reality was far worse than even my craven imaginings.
"Exactly,"
Zyvan made the sign of the Aquila.
"But if she's not, those ships and men will be needed to defend the Imperium. And it's not just the Nids."
He trailed off as Amberley shot him a venomous look. Clearly I wasn't supposed to be let in on everything.
"Necrons," I said, jumping to the obvious conclusion. I pointed out the tomb world I'd been lucky to escape from a couple of years before.
not the friendliest of Xenos, and cropping up more frequently of late, if these contact icons are anything to go by. I indicated a couple of others in the same purple script.
That would be pure speculation, Commissar, Amberlee said, a clear warning tone entering her voice, but Mott nodded enthusiastically.
A 273% increase in probable Necron contact over the last century, he said. Only 28% fully confirmed, however.
That would be because the majority of contacts left no survivors, of course.
Be that as it may, Amberlee said, the fact remains that the resources we would expend fighting a war for Gravilax are likely to be needed elsewhere, and if we're forced to use them now, we would be fatally weakened.
Which still begs the question of who would be insane enough to try to provoke such a war, and what they would hope to gain by it, I said, eager to show I was paying attention.
Precisely what the Inquisitor was sent here to find out, Zyvan assured me.
Not exactly. Amberlee killed the hololith display, probably to stop me from making any more uncomfortable guesses about what might be lurking in the outer darkness. Our attention was drawn to the increase in Tau influence on Gravilax and the activities of certain rogue traders who seemed to be profiting from it. I came to look into that and assess the loyalties of the Governor.
That's why you had Aurelius pressuring him for trade concessions, I said, the coin suddenly dropping. You wanted to see if he had any influence with the Tau.
Quite right. She smiled at me, like a scholar tutor whose least promising pupil has just recited the entire catechism of abjuration. You're really quite astute for a soldier.
And your decision? Zyvan asked, carefully not taking offence at the remark.
I'm still considering it, she admitted. He's certainly weak, probably corrupt, and undeniably stupid. He's let the alien influence take root here far too deeply to be dislodged without considerable effort, but he's no longer our primary concern.
You mean the conspirators? I asked. Whoever's trying to provoke a war over this?
Precisely, she nodded, favouring me with another smile, which, perhaps due to wishful thinking, looked remarkably like praise. Another astute deduction on your part.
Do you have any clue as to their identities? Zyvan asked.
Amberlee shook her head. There's no shortage of enemies who would stand to gain from weakening the Imperial presence in this sector, she said, with a warning glance at Mott, who seemed on the verge of listing them. Not at least the Tau themselves. He subsided with visible disappointment. But whoever it is undoubtedly working through the Xenoist faction here and the PDF units they control. Fortunately, the guards seem to have drawn their teeth without dragging the Tau into it, for which we can all be thankful.
Zyvan and I took the implied compliment without comment. How is the investigation into the ambassador's murder going? I asked. If you find the assassin, you find the conspirators, don't you?
Probably, Amberlee shook her head. But so far we don't have a suspect. The autopsy showed he was killed by an Imperial bolt pistol at close range, but we already knew that, and half the guests at the party were carrying one. Our best lead is still the Xenoist connection.
Or it was,
Mott chimed in with a censorial glare at me,
until this young man set fire to it.
I'm sorry, I gazed at him in confusion.
So you should be,
he said without rancour. Amberlee sighed.
The local Arbetes have been keeping tabs on the most vocal Xenoist groups. One of them used to hold meetings at that warehouse, so we went to check it out.
And found a bit more than you bargained for, I chipped in helpfully. She nodded.
That we did. We found a way down to the Undercity.
Definite surprise there,
Mott chipped in helpfully.
Although given the amount of relatively new Tau-influenced architecture in the city as a whole, finding one wasn't totally unexpected.
I suppose I must seem naive, but up until this point it had never occurred to me that there wasn't an Undercity. Part and parcel of growing up in a hive, I suppose. You see, most Imperial cities are millennia old, each generation building on the remains of the last, leaving a warren of service tunnels and abandoned rooms under the latest level of streets and buildings, often tens or even hundreds of meters thick. Mayo, being so sparsely populated in Imperial terms, didn't have anything like so thick a layer beneath it, but I'd just taken it for granted that it was bound to have the same labyrinth of sewers and walkways below its citizens' feet as any other urban area I was familiar with. "Seems like a good place to plot sedition," I conceded.
"Ideal," Amberley agreed,
"as we found to our cost."
"We were ambushed," Mott said, "though not before determining that the tunnel system is extremely extensive."
"Ambushed by who?"
Zyvon asked.
"Ah, well, that's the question." Amberley cocked her head quizzically. "Whoever they were well-armed and well-trained. We barely got out alive."
"Tomas and Jocelyn didn't,"
Mott reminded her, and her brow darkened for a moment. "Their sacrifice will be remembered," she said in the reflex way people do when they don't really mean it. "They knew the risks."
"More PDF defectors?" Zyvon asked.
I shook my head.
"I don't think so. My aide and I got a good look at several of them. They were definitely civilians."
"Or in civilian clothes," Mott suggested. "Not necessarily the same thing."
"In either case," Amberley said decisively, "we need more information, and there's only one place we can get it."
I began to develop a familiar sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach.
"The Undercity,"
Zyvon said. The Inquisitor nodded.
"Precisely, which is why I require your assistance."
"Anything at all, of course," Zyvon spread his hands. "Although I don't quite see..."
"My retinue is out of action, Lord General, and I'm not stupid enough to undertake an expedition of this nature entirely alone."
"Well, anyone could see that."
"I'd like to request the use of some of your guard troopers."
"Well, of course," Zyvon nodded. "You can hardly rely on the loyalty of the local PDF."
"Exactly," she nodded again.
"How many do you want?"
Zyvon asked.
"A platoon? A company?"
Amberley shook her head.
"No. We'll need to move fast and light. One fire team, and the Commissar to lead them."
She turned those dazzling eyes on me again and smiled. "I'm sure a man of your formidable reputation will be up to the challenge."
"Oh, I wasn't. You can take my word for it. But I couldn't refuse a direct request from an Inquisitor, could I? Although if I'd known what I was getting into, I'd probably have given it a damn good try." So I nodded and tried to look confident.
"You can rely on me," I said with all the sincerity I could fake. And from the grin which quirked the corner of her mouth, I could tell she wasn't fooled for a second.
"I'm glad to hear it," she said.
"I gather your regiment has had a great deal of experience in city fighting, so I'm sure they'll be ideal."
"I'll ask for volunteers," I said.
But she shook her head.
"No need."
She skimmed a data slate over the tabletop to me.
I stopped it, a premonitory tingle beginning in the palms of my hands.
"You've already assigned some."
I glanced at the list of names, already knowing, in the way you can see the avalanche start even before the rocks begin to slide, what I'd read there. Kelp, Trebek, Valade, Sorrel, and Hollenby. The five troopers on the planet I'd least trust to watch my back, unless it was to stick a bayonet in it. I lifted my head.
"Are you sure, Inquisitor? These troopers are hardly the most reliable,
but they are the most expendable." She grinned at me, the mischievous light back in her eyes. "And I'm sure you can keep them in line for me."
It was official, then.
This was a suicide mission. I swallowed, my mouth suddenly dry.
"You can count on it," I said,
wondering how in the name of the Emperor I was going to get out of this one.
Chapter 10
"Trust? Trust's got nothing to do with it. I just don't want them out of my sight."
General Karras, after promising full access to his command bunker to the local PDF commanders on Vortovan.
"Are you sure about this, Commissar?" Custine asked, clearly as troubled by the prospect as I was. She and Brocklaw had joined me in my office at my request, and I'd filled them in on as much of the assignment I'd been handed as Amberley would permit. I sighed deeply.
"No, I'm not," I admitted. But the Inquisitor was quite insistent. "These are the troopers she wants."
"Well, we'd better give them to her,"
Brocklaw said. At least they'll be off our hands at last.
Castine nodded, clearly cheered by the prospect.
That's true, she conceded. Despite my best efforts to arrange their transfer to a penal legion, the Munitorium was proving as slow and obstructive as usual, and didn't seem the least bit inclined to send a ship all the way out here just to pick up a handful of cannon fodder. Normally, that wouldn't have been a problem. I'd simply have found space on the next outbound freighter or something, but Gravelax wasn't exactly the hub of the Segmentum. And even what little shipping there normally was had almost dried up as the political situation deteriorated. Even if the worst-case scenario I'd been shown on the Hololith didn't come to pass, it looked as though we were going to be stuck with the 5 defaulters until we returned to Imperial space, which was going to be months away at this rate. Which, in turn, had meant they were our responsibility for the foreseeable future. Which wasn't exactly what I'd had in mind when I cheated Parjita out of his firing squad back aboard the Righteous Wrath. And on the plus side, Brocklaw went on cheerfully, at least we won't be losing anyone we'll miss. He stopped suddenly, realized what he'd just said, and floundered in a way I would have found comical under any other circumstances. Not you, Commissar, obviously. I mean, we would miss you, but I'm sure we won't. I have to, I mean, you'll be back. I certainly intend to be, I said, with more confidence than I felt. I still hadn't been able to think of a plausible reason to wriggle out of the assignment, so I'd bowed to the inevitable and started trying to find ways of ensuring my own survival instead. None of the troopers could be trusted, that much was certain, but Amberlee seemed confident enough, so my best bet was to stick close to her and hope she had a plan of some kind. On the other hand, chances were that Aurelius's luckless bodyguards had thought the same thing. Like most hivers, I was comfortable enough in a tunnel complex unless someone was actually shooting at me. So maybe the most prudent thing would be to get conveniently lost at the earliest opportunity and make my way back to the compound after a reasonable interval had passed. Then again, if I did that and Amberlee survived, she wouldn't be terribly pleased with me, to say the least. And the prospect of hacking off an Inquisitor wasn't one to contemplate lightly. The upshot of all this was that I'd spent a largely sleepless night vacillating about my non-existent choices until sheer exhaustion had tumbled me into old nightmares of fleeing from gleaming metal killers down endless corridors, heaving grey masses of tyrannid chitin roaring in towards me like a tide of death, and a green-eyed seductress trying to suck the soul from my body in the name of the chaos power she worshipped.
These dreams would appear to refer obliquely to some of Cain's earlier experiences. The last one in particular can certainly be matched to a specific incident recorded elsewhere in the archive, although the others are a little more problematic. He had encountered both Necrons and Tyranids on more than one occasion prior to this date.
And probably others too, which I was glad not to recall on waking. Jürgen appeared at my elbow, presaged by his usual miasma, and poured me my habitual bowl of tanner-leaf tea. Instead of withdrawing as he normally did, though, he hesitated next to my desk.
"Was there something else, Jürgen?" I asked, anticipating some routine query about paperwork I couldn't be bothered to deal with. If I was going to die today, I wasn't going to waste my final hours filling out forms in triplicate. And if I didn't, which I swore to the Emperor I was going to do my damnedest to achieve, he could sort it out for me while I was gone. That was supposed to be an aide job, after all. He cleared his throat stickily, and a faint expression of nausea ghosted across Brocklaw's face.
"I'd like to go with you, sir," he said at last. "I wouldn't trust any of those frackheads further than I could throw a bane blade, if you don't mind me saying so. And I'd feel a lot better if you'd let me watch your back." I was touched, and I don't mind admitting it. We'd been campaigning together for the best part of 13 years by that point, and faced innumerable perils together. But his loyalty never ceased to amaze me. Probably because the nearest I've ever got to the concept myself is looking it up in a dictionary.
"Thank you, Jürgen," I said. "I'd be honoured."
A faint flush crept up from behind his shirt collar, which, as usual, was open at the neck and stained with something that probably used to be food. Castine and Brocklaw looked suitably impressed too.
"I'd best go and get ready, then,"
He sketched a salute, about-turned with the closest I'd ever seen him get to precision, and marched out, his shoulders set.
"Remarkable," Brocklaw said.
"He has a strong sense of duty," I said, feeling cautiously optimistic about my chances of survival for the first time since Amberley dropped her bombshell. We'd been in some pretty tight spots together over the years, and I knew I could rely on him completely, which is more than I could say for anyone else in the team.
"He's a brave man,"
Castine said, seemingly surprised by the idea. Most people tended to avoid him, put off by his appearance and body odour and the vague sense of wrongness he exuded. But I'd been close to him for so long, I got used to seeing past that to his well-hidden virtues, though I was the last person you'd normally expect to appreciate them.
"I suppose he is," I said.
"Well, there they are," I said. "They're all yours." Amberley nodded and walked along the line of troopers, meeting their eyes one by one. They were as sullen a bunch as I remembered, gazing back at us in silence. I'd had them march to one of the storage sheds in our sector of the compound at the double, and was pleased to note that none of them seemed particularly out of breath, so their weeks of confinement hadn't left them as out of condition as I'd feared. But then I don't suppose they'd had much to do except exercise anyway. They'd looked vaguely surprised when I dismissed the guards, except for Sorrel, whose expression never seemed to change whatever happened, and stared at me as I sat casually on a nearby crate.
"I promised you a chance to redeem yourselves," I said. "And that chance has now come."
That got their attention. Valade looked vaguely apprehensive, Hollenby baffled as always, and even Sorrel seemed to take slightly more interest than usual. Kelp and Trebek just stared at me, but at least they didn't seem inclined to go for one another again. Perhaps it was my personal charisma, or my unmerited reputation, but it was most likely the las pistol in the holster at my hip, which I'd visibly left unfastened for a quick draw. I gestured to Amberley, who stepped forward from the shadows, the black cloak she'd worn before, rendering her almost invisible until she moved. "This is Inquisitor Vale. She has a little job for us." The lad gasped audibly as Amberley raised her hand, and her Electu flashed into visibility. Dressed in black as she was, she fit the popular conception of an Inquisitor far more closely than the sultry lounge singer that I'd first encountered, or the cheerful young woman I'd been getting to know, and I could tell that most of them, at least, were properly intimidated.
"What kind of a job?" Trebek asked.
I waited for Amberley to reply, but after a moment I realized she was leaving the briefing to me. Not that I knew much more than the rest of us, of course, but I'd pass on everything I could. The longer they survived, the longer I could hide behind them from whatever was waiting for us in the tunnels below.
"Recon," I said. "Into the Undercity. Resistance is expected."
"Resistance from who?" Trebek asked. I shrugged. "That's what we're supposed to find out."
"I take it we aren't expected to survive,"
Kelp cut in. Amberley met his eyes, staring him down. "That rather depends on you," she said. "The Commissar certainly intends to. I suggest you follow his lead."
"It's not going to make any difference to us anyway, is it?"
Valade asked with surprising vehemence. "Even if we get through this one alive, we've only got another suicide mission to look forward to."
"I'd worry about that later if I were you," I said.
But Amberley was nodding slowly, as though she was being perfectly reasonable. I certainly wouldn't have mouthed off to an Inquisitor in her boots, but I suppose she felt she had nothing to lose in any case.
"Good point, Griselda," she said.
Valade and the others looked a little taken aback at the use of her given name. I recognized the technique as a subtle piece of psychological manipulation, quietly enjoying the chance to watch an expert at work. Amberley smiled. Suddenly, the full force of her capricious personality manifesting itself again.
"All right, you need an incentive. If you make it back in one piece, you have my word you won't be transferred to a penal legion. How's that?"
A total pain in the fundament, so far as I was concerned. The paperwork alone would be a nightmare, not to mention the morale and disciplinary problems which would undoubtedly ensue from trying to integrate such an insubordinate rabble back into a line company. I wasn't about to undermine my own authority by having it verbally overridden by an inquisitor in front of them, though, so I stayed quiet. Maybe I could get them transferred to another command, or assigned somewhere relatively harmless after she'd gone. The local PDF could certainly use a professional training cadre to bring them up to scratch once this mess was sorted out, and we were hardly likely to be coming back to Gravelax.
All of us?
Hollenby asked, clearly not quite believing his own ears. Amberley shrugged.
Well, she did ask first, but I suppose so. Wouldn't be much of an incentive for the rest of you otherwise, would it?
No one answered, so I resumed the briefing. An undetermined number of hostiles are holed up down there. Our job is to find out how many, their disposition, and what they're up to.
Do we have a map of the tunnels? Kelp asked.
For what it was worth, they seemed to be focusing on the mission, at least. I turned to Amberley.
Inquisitor?
I asked. She shook her head.
No, we didn't penetrate very far the first time before we were forced to retreat. We've very little idea of their extent or what's down there.
Who's we? Trebek asked.
My associates, Amberley replied.
Trebek glanced pointedly around the shed.
I can only see you.
The others were injured. That's why I need you. No mention of the dead ones, I noticed, which was probably just as well. It wouldn't fool the troopers anyway. They knew enough about firefights in confined spaces to realize that not everyone she'd gone down there with would have made it out.
So to recap, Cup said, you want us to go into an unmapped labyrinth, looking for something you think might be down there, but you don't know what, protected by an indeterminate number of heavily armed guards, and the last time you tried, you were the only one who made it out in one piece.
That about sums it up, yes, Amberley admitted cheerfully.
But you are forgetting one thing.
Which is? I asked, already sure I wouldn't like the answer.
They know I'm onto them now.
She smiled, as though it were a tremendous joke. So this time they'll be expecting us.
Another question.
Sorrel spoke up for the first time, puncturing the somber silence.
Your generous offer notwithstanding, you've obviously chosen us because we're expendable.
His voice was as flat and colourless as his eyes.
I assume you're not expecting many survivors from this little excursion.
As I said before, that rather depends on you.
Amberley nailed him with her eyes.
I certainly intend to come back. So does the Commissar.
She'd got that right, at least.
And your question is?
What's to stop any of us putting a Lazran through your head and disappearing over the horizon the first chance we get?
His wintry gaze swept the other prisoners.
Don't tell me you're not all thinking about it.
Good point. Amberley smiled, the amused expression I'd seen before back on her face. If it disconcerted Sorrel, he gave no sign of the fact, but it certainly worried the others. She jerked a thumb in my direction.
There's always the Commissar to get past before you can reach me, of course.
And I'll execute any one of you who even looks like they're thinking of making a run for it, I promised.
I would, too, because they'd have to kill me as well if they would have a hope of getting away with it, and that would be a highly undesirable outcome from my point of view.
Even if you could take us both, and the amusement was abruptly gone from her voice, and I sincerely doubt that, I've lost count of the number of people I've met who thought they could outrun the Inquisition, but you might as well give it a try if you really want to.
Then the undercurrent of mirth was back in her voice.
After all, there's a first time for everything.
I smiled, too, to demonstrate my confidence in her, but none of the others did.
Sorrel nodded slowly, like a debater conceding a point.
Fair enough,
he said.
No one had anything constructive to add, so after a few more desultory questions about the mission parameters, the answers to which all boiled down to Emperor only knows, in any case, I led them outside to where Jürgen had a Chimera waiting, its engine running, and tried to look confident. I would have preferred my usual scout salamander given the choice, but there wouldn't have been room for the entire team aboard it, and besides, the fully enclosed passenger bay would discourage any last-minute attempts at desertion, or so I hoped. "Your equipment's already aboard," I told them, standing well back until they'd embarked.
like an ovine hound shepherding a flock through a gate. Although the canines tend not to use las pistols to emphasize the point, of course. 5 bundles of kit were waiting for them, each one wrapped in a carapace vest with a name stenciled on it, and they all picked out their own as they boarded. "Check it carefully," Amberley told them. "If there's anything missing, you won't get a chance to come back for it." "Discharge papers?" Trebek said, raising a tension-relieving laugh from Villade and Hollenby. "Something's wrong here," Kelp said, shrugging into the body armor. "It fits. Quartermaster must be slipping." It was an axiom among the guard that kit only came in 2 sizes, 2 large and 2 small. "I had a word with him," Amberley said. "He assured me that there wouldn't be any complaints."
"I'll just bet he did," Kelp muttered.
"Helgun, shady!" Villade hefted a new weapon, looking incongruously like a juvie on Emperor's Day morning. As a regular line trooper, she was only used to handling a standard-issue lasgun, the more powerful variant normally being reserved for stormtroopers and other special forces. At least her evident enthusiasm for her new toy seemed to be keeping her apprehension in check. "Nice," Kelp agreed, snapping a power cell home with practiced precision. "We thought the extra punch might come in handy," I said. Amberley had suggested I replace my battered old las pistol with the handgun version of the heavier weapon, but after some hesitation, I demurred. I got so used to it over the years that it was more like an extension of my own arm than a weapon, and no amount of added stopping power would compensate for the different weight and feel of a replacement throwing off my instinctive aim. In a firefight, that could mean the difference between life and death. I'd grabbed a set of the body armor, though, and wore it now, concealed beneath my uniform greatcoat. It felt a little heavy and uncomfortable, but a lot less so than taking a las bolt to the chest. "It just might," Trebek agreed. She was busily hanging frag grenades from her body harness. Most of them had a couple, along with smoke canisters, luminators, spare power packs, and all the other odds and ends troopers carry into the field. The exception was Hollenby, who carried a med pack in place of the grenades, but his expertise in battlefield medicine made him more valuable patching the others up if the necessity arose. And if it came down to grenades in a confined space, we were pretty much fragged in any case, so a couple more or less wouldn't make any difference. "You can take the brute force approach if you like." Sorrel sighted along the length of his long las and made a minute adjustment to the targeter. "I'd taken the trouble to find the weapon that used to be assigned to him, knowing that a sniper gets as attached to his weapon as I was to my old pistol, and that he would have customized it in a dozen subtle ways to improve its accuracy."
"I've got all the edge I need right here."
He must have realized the strings I'd had to pull to obtain it for him, because he met my eyes at that point and nodded, a barely perceptible thanks. I was astonished. Up until then, I'd been convinced he had no emotions at all. "Just make sure you keep it pointed in the right direction," I said, with enough of a smile to take most of the sting out of the warning. It was still there, though, and an expression I couldn't quite identify came close to surfacing on his habitually impassive face. "I could use a few more pressure pads," Hollenby said, inventorying the medkit with the speed of long practice. I gestured to the primary aid box bolted to the Chimera's inner bulkhead. "Help yourself," I invited. He burrowed rapidly through it, scavenging several items which made the bag on his belt bulge, and stowed a few more in other pouches and pockets, discarding a couple of ration bars to make room for them. "Better eat that," Villade advised, taking the seat next to him. "You'll only get hungry later if you leave it."
"Yeah, right,"
he agreed, breaking one in half and offering the rest to her. She took it with a smile, their hands touching for a moment as her fingers closed around it, and Amberley grinned at me. "Aw," she mouthed, her back to them. "How sweet." Maybe to her, I thought, but to me, it was little more than another potential complication in a catastrophe just waiting to happen. I quelled my irritation and picked the remaining bar off the bench. "She's got a point." I split the bar with Amberley.
"Better stock up with carbohydrates while you can. You'll be burning a lot of energy soon enough."
"You're the expert," she said, as though anyone else's opinions mattered a damn on this foolhardy expedition. She sniffed at the grey fibrous mass and bit into it cautiously.
you people actually eat this frack?
Not if we can help it, Valade said.
Then I'm definitely surviving this.
Amberley swallowed the remains of her ration bar with a grimace of distaste. No way that's going to be my last meal. The troopers all laughed, even Sorrel, and I marvelled again at her powers of manipulation.
Coming from Kane, that's a real compliment.
By playing the civilian outsider, she'd reinforced their sense of identity as soldiers with great subtlety. I doubted whether it would be quite enough to weld them into a cohesive unit, but that wasn't really an issue on this assignment. All that was necessary was that they work well enough together to get Amberley the intelligence she required, and me out in one piece, of course. There were still far too many weak links for my liking, though. Kelp and Trebek were professional enough to put their rivalries aside for long enough to get the job done, I hoped, especially with an inquisitorial pardon up for grabs, but the way they kept avoiding eye contact with each other was a far from encouraging sign. And whatever was going on between Valade and Hollenby might just be enough for them to put their concern for each other ahead of the mission objective, or the survival of anyone else. Like me. And as for Sorrel, well, he flat out gave me the creeps, and I was determined not to let him get anywhere I couldn't keep an eye on him. I'd met psychopaths before, and he had all the hallmarks. He wouldn't hesitate to sacrifice the rest of us to save his own skin. Of that, I was sure.
An old expression about pots and kettles springs to mind at this point, as well as the saying about taking one to know one.
And then there was Amberley. Charming as I found her, she was still an inquisitor above all else. And that meant that all we were to her was a means to an end. A noble and important one, no doubt. But that would be of little comfort to me when the black bell tolled.
He is speaking figuratively here, the tolling of the Black Bell of Terror being a well-known soldier's euphemism for death in action. I hardly think he would have expected such an accolade in actual fact.
So it was little wonder that my palms were tingling as I closed the tail ramp and activated my combead.
All right, Jürgen, I said. We're ready to go.
This time, there were no waves and cheers as we left the compound, although I had no doubt that the rumour mill had spread the news of our departure just as far as before. I was quietly relieved by that, to be honest, as this was to be no easy victory for our newly forged regiment to take pride in and celebrate. This would be a desperate struggle for survival. I didn't need my itching palms to tell me that. Although how desperate, and against how terrible a foe, I still at that time had no inkling. And that was a mercy, let me tell you. If I'd known then what awaited us in the undercity of Mayo, I would probably have broken down in hysterics from sheer terror. As it was, I masked my concern with the ease of long practice and kept a stern eye on the troopers, hoping any agitation I felt would be mistaken for vigilance. To my relief, they seemed to be settling, focusing more on the mission now that it was underway. And if they weren't exactly on the same wavelength yet, at least they weren't jamming each other. That reminded me I hadn't reported our departure to Castine yet, so I retuned my combead to the command frequency and exchanged a few words with her. As I'd expected, her mood was somber, and she wished me luck as though she thought I might actually need it. I was beginning to find the tense atmosphere inside the vehicle a little claustrophobic, not to mention being rattled around like a pea in a can by Jürgen's habitual driving style. So I popped the turret hatch and stuck my head out for some fresh air. The sudden rush was invigorating, almost taking my cap with it as I emerged, and I checked the heavy bolter so I'd have an excuse for staying out there as long as I could. It was primed and ready, of course, Jürgen having done his usual thorough job, so I was able to settle back and enjoy the spectacle of the local civilian traffic swerving out of our way. There seemed to be a lot of it, I noticed, particularly in the main boulevards, but there was no obvious pattern to the movement. There was just as much going in each direction, and when I glanced down the crossways, they all seemed choked as well. Inquisitor, I sub-vocalized, switching to the channel Amberley had given me earlier. I hadn't seen any sign of a bead in her ear, but that didn't surprise me. For all I knew, she'd disguised it in some way or was stuffed with augmetics that did the same job, and a great many others, as I was to discover over the course of our association. There seems to be a lot of civilian activity. Anything we should be aware of? There was actually a great deal we should have been aware of. Of course, the conspiracy we tracked was far more extensive and dangerous than we had imagined, but at that point, I was still blissfully ignorant of how much trouble we were in. "Probably lots of things," Amberley sounded wary, though not particularly concerned. "But we'll just have to make do with what we know and proceed with caution." Easier said than done with Jürgen driving, I thought, but she was the expert. I watched as he swerved us around a slow-moving cargo lifter, its flatbed jammed with civilians carrying hastily assembled bundles of possessions. Probably just spooked by our raid on the heights, but the implications troubled me. I began to look out for similar sights, and found several in the space of a handful of seconds. I voxed Amberley again. "It's looking like refugee traffic up here," I said. "Intriguing," she responded, a note of curiosity entering her voice. "What would they be fleeing, I wonder?" "Nothing good," I said, speaking from bitter experience. "Although, in truth, it wouldn't be that unexpected for anyone who could to be leaving the city by now. The political and military situation was still balanced on a knife edge, and it wouldn't need someone of Mott's intellect to deduce that things would be a lot healthier somewhere else if it all boiled over. No harm in checking everything, I thought. So I hopped through the tactical frequencies, finding a lot of garbled traffic on the PDF net. Very little of it seemed to be making sense, though. "Commissar," Castine's voice cut in suddenly, "I think you should know we've just had instructions to go to combat readiness." "Who from?" Amberley interrupted before I could respond. I suppose I might have resented her butting in, let alone monitoring my supposedly secure messages, but right then I was too busy swinging the bolt around and taking the safety off. A thick column of smoke was visible ahead of us, rising from a burning truck in the middle of the road, and the traffic was beginning to stall and gridlock as panicked drivers tried to find a way around it or turn back. Bright las bolts were scoring the air, but who was shooting and what they were aiming at remained obscured behind the smoke. "By order of the governor," Castine said. "Imbecile," Amberley said, along with some qualifying adjectives, which I'd last heard in an underhive drinking den when someone turned out to have more than the conventional number of emperors in their tarot deck. I began to suspect that Governor Grice's political future was going to be short and uncomfortable. "We'll have the tower on our asses like flies round a corpse." "I think we already have," I said. Something was moving inside the smoke, fast and agile, twice the height of a man. It wasn't alone, either. There were more of them moving back there, and the whole pack of them was surrounded by little darting dots. I suddenly remembered the flying platters we'd seen at the Tau Enclave, and that they were armed too. Abruptly, unnervingly, the leading dreadnought, the same type El Sarath had called battle suits, swung its head in our direction and turned, a pair of long-barreled weapons mounted on its shoulders coming to bear. We were still a long way away from being an easy target, but I've always been cautious, so I hailed our driver. "Jürgen," I shouted, "get us out of here." By way of reply, he swung us abruptly towards a narrow alleyway, crushing a raised bed of ornamental shrubs beneath our left-hand tread and barging a small, sleek ground car out of the way. The driver's volley of profanity was drowned out by a sudden thunderclap of displaced air as something hit the front of an omnibus right where we'd been a moment before, reducing its entire nose to metallic confetti before raking the length of it, blowing a tangled mass of wreckage, blood and bone out of the back. Before I could see anything more, we were behind the shelter of a building, our hurtling metallic shell gouging lumps out of the walls, our tracks leaving a trail of burst and flattened waste containers in our wake. "Emperor's bowels," I said, stunned by the narrowness of our escape. "What was that?" Amberley asked, her voice almost drowned out by the complaints of the troopers around her. I tried to explain the best I could, still shaken by the range and accuracy of the weapon deployed against us. "Sounds like a railgun," she said, apparently unperturbed. "Nasty things." "Could it have damaged us?" I asked, making sure the spare ammo boxes were in easy reach. There was nothing ahead of us now except more panicking civilians, but I wasn't planning on being taken by surprise twice, you can be sure. "Easily," she replied cheerfully. "Even at that range it could have gutted us like a fish." "The Emperor protects," Jürgen said piously. "Well, he hadn't done a hell of a lot for the bus passengers, I thought, but decided it wouldn't be tactful to say so. He'd only take it as a sign that we were important to his ineffable plan anyway.
"Who were the Tau engaging?" I asked.
"The PDF," Castine said. "Who else? We're getting reports in that some of the loyalists have mutinied and opened fire on the Tau compound. The diplomats are trying to calm things, but the Blueys are claiming they have a right to retaliate and have entered the city. They're engaging every PDF unit they come across."
"What about the guard?" I asked, already sure I wouldn't like the answer.
"The governor's orders are to contain the situation by any means necessary. The Lord General is asking for clarification."
Playing for time, in other words. If the guard units entered the city, they'd be caught in the middle. With half the PDF unreliable, they'd become a target for both sides. My stomach lurched, and for once, it wasn't due to Jürgen's driving.
"Well, that's it, then," I said, the words like ashes in my mouth. "We've run out of time. The war that so many people had sacrificed so much to avoid was upon us at last, and it seemed there wasn't a damn thing we could do about it."
Editorial note. It goes without saying that the unrest which Kane noticed breaking out across the city was being duplicated to a lesser extent across the whole of Gravelax. Although with the bulk of both the Imperial and Tau expeditionary forces based around the capital, the situation deteriorated further and faster in Mayo than anywhere else on the planet. Minor clashes did take place around several of the starports, as both sides realized keeping them open or denying them to the enemy would be vital in either reinforcing or evacuating their forces. For the most part, the warfare was internecine, pro- and anti-Xenoist factions within the PDF turning on one another with a terrible ferocity unique to civil war. The following extract may prove useful in appreciating the wider picture. From Purge the Guilty, an impartial account of the liberation of Gravelax, by Stententious Logar, 085.M42.
Thus it was, spurred by the workings of a vast malign conspiracy, the entire world was rent asunder in an orgy of fratricide, which shames the survivors and their descendants even to the present day. If anything at all can be said to have been learned from these terrible events, it must surely be this, that however benign they may appear, the alien is not to be trusted, and that turning aside from the word of the Emperor in even the smallest respect is the most certain route to damnation for us all. It must have been the belated realization of this which spurred the loyal cadre of Planetary Defense Force regulars into turning on the traitors in their midst, taking heart from the salutary way in which the Imperial Guard had dealt with the alien lovers who had dared to desecrate the streets of an Imperial city with open rebellion. Their patriotic fervor, at last aroused, His Divine Majesty's most loyal servants began to cleanse the hideous stain on their honor in the only way possible, by shedding the blood of those whose craven panderings to the aliens in their midst had led the whole planet to the very brink of the abyss. At first, the renewal of martial spirit was sporadic, beginning with the arrest of those unit commanders whose loyalties were, for one reason or another, suspect. Inevitably, however, faced with the threat of exposure, those whose souls were stained with the guilt of collaboration resisted, proving their black-heartedness by opening fire on the heroic defenders of imperial virtue. The rot spread exponentially after that, until almost every PDF unit was engaged on one side or the other. Indeed, such was the confusion that many were unable to tell friend from foe, and simply engaged every other unit they encountered indiscriminately. Under these circumstances, it was hardly surprising that the most fervent of the loyalists lost no time in placing the blame squarely on the shoulders of those ultimately responsible, the Xenos themselves, and resolved to rid our world of the taint of their presence without further delay. These heroes of legendary proportions, whose names would undoubtedly ring down the ages of Gravelax forevermore, if enough of their bodies had remained intact to identify, turned on the corruption at its source and threw themselves against the very citadel of the invader. Alas, faced with the overwhelming firepower of this redoubt of the unholy, they were cut to pieces, but the damage had been done.
Aware for the first time of their own vulnerability, the Tau advanced into the city to slaughter the righteous, and the very future of Gravellax hung in the balance. Throughout these events, one question remains unanswered. Why did the Imperial Guard take so long to respond? Accusations of cowardice are clearly ridiculous, if not treasonous, the Lord General's reputation alone being sufficient to belie them without a moment's thought. Once again, the only credible explanation is that of conspiracy, some dark machination hindering their deployment for reasons we can only guess at. As to the hand behind that conspiracy, a careful sifting of the evidence once again points us firmly to the shadowy presence of the rogue traders.
And after a reasonably concise summary of events up to that point, he veers off on his personal obsession once more. Perhaps it's just as well, though. If anyone were to deduce the real enemy we were facing, we would have to take steps to obscure the truth.
Chapter 11. Whatever happens, we have got the Emperor's blessing. They have not. From The Guardsman's Duty, a popular ballad. The warehouse was just as we'd left it, which is to say it was a tangled mess of collapsed rubble and gently smoking debris. As we disembarked from the Chimera, the scent of old burning caught at the back of my throat, making me cough. We hadn't seen any more of the supernaturally fast Tau dreadnoughts before we reached our destination, but I remained cautious nevertheless, ordering the troopers to consider the area enemy territory as we left the relative safety of the armoured carrier. What little I'd been able to glean from the Vox traffic was less than encouraging, and my attempts to get through to someone more senior at Divisional HQ for clarification were futile. No one there seemed to have a clue what was going on either. Besides, this was the Inquisitor's little expedition, and she showed no sign of calling it off, so I gave up after a while and just let her get on with it. "It seems clear enough," Amberley said, consulting an Auspex she'd produced from somewhere, and for a moment I wondered what else the dark cape concealed. Nevertheless, the troopers debarked with commendable precision, covering each other as they moved, Kelp on point, while the others remained protected by the vehicle's armour plate until he'd reached the cover of a nearby heap of rubble, then Trebek, who headed for a tumbled wall on the opposite flank. Once they were established, Velayde followed, taking up a position behind them, then Hollenby, who, I noticed, picked a spot where he could cover her as effectively as possible, despite leaving a small blind spot in his coverage of Trebek. After a moment's hesitation, I decided to let it go just this once. After all, they weren't the most cohesive team I might have wished for, and it could have been an honest mistake. Sorrel swept the area with the targeter of his long las and raised a hand.
"It's clear, Commissar," he said. "You can move."
"After you," I said. He shrugged almost imperceptibly and was gone, crouching low, hurrying over the uneven ground to a point about 50 meters ahead of Kelp, where a fallen structural beam lay across a tumbled internal wall. He scrambled up it, worming his way into a gap between the chunks of masonry, and froze, scanning the rubble around us through his magnifying sight. If I hadn't been keeping an eye on him the whole way, I would barely have known he was there. Amberley raised a quizzical eyebrow at me. "Or wouldn't it have been more prudent to have moved out while he kept you covered?" she asked.
"Any other sharpshooter, yes," I said. "But after what he said at the briefing..."
"Better safe than sorry," she finished for me.
I nodded, and indicated the open ramp.
"Whenever you're ready, Inquisitor." "After you," she said. And I almost missed the grin that accompanied her echo of my own words. I wouldn't have been all that surprised if she didn't trust me, mind you. I wouldn't have trusted me either, but then I suppose I know myself better than most. So I smiled in return, to let her think I thought she was joking, and dropped to the ground, my boots crunching on the scattered ash. Jürgen had left the driver's compartment by now, and I was joined by his odour, followed an instant later by the man himself. In spite of myself, my eyebrows rose. "Are you sure you're not a little lightly armed for this?" I asked, and a momentary frown of concern flashed across his face before he realized I was joking. "Like the rest of us, except for Amberley, for all I knew she might have concealed hers the way I had, He was wearing a carapace jacket, but in a reassuring nod to the guard I knew, this was definitely one of the standard sizes. Too big. Although most of his kit looked like that at the best of times. He had a hell gun like the others, but it was slung across his shoulders. In his hands was the unmistakable bulk of a melter gun.